This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is a podcast that I've been very much looking forward to. Because today we're going to talk to a star in her field who can share with us some information about a paradigm in the field of nutrition that is really a revolutionary paradigm. You know, it's only maybe a couple of times a decade that a new, dramatically different paradigm comes onto our radar screens as diagnosticians and as physicians, that really changes the way we look at things and offers us a new tool, like leverage on enhancing patients' outcomes. And I can think of a few like that. You know, the yeast connection back in the 70s and 80s, the role of omega-3 fatty acids around that same time, oxidative stress sort of in the late 20th century, the role of vitamin D that has emerged over the past 10 or 15 years. But this has to do with B vitamins. And the key word here is methylation. We're going to talk to one of the foremost interpreters of the subject of methylation, which gets very complicated. She's Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. Kara is a naturopathic physician. She received her doctorate of naturopathic medicine from the National College of Natural Medicine, Portland, Oregon. She's a practitioner, but she's actually a teacher of physicians. She's lead author and editor of Case Studies in Integrative and Functional Medicine, which is a big deal because that's where a lot of integrative physicians get trained. And she also has updated the textbook for functional medicine, which a lot of doctors rely upon. And she's been published in numerous peer-reviewed journals. Dr. Fitzgerald is also in practice in Connecticut. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dr. Hoffman. It's likewise great to be with you and just hear your, you know, years of experience in this field. I appreciate it so much.
Well, indeed. Yeah, and, you know, I have to say that when I began practice, we had no idea that there was such a concept. So it's exciting. It's like, you know, new dimension in our understanding of patients. And it's not the end-all and be-all of, you know, how to deal with patients, but it just gives us a new tool for dealing with complex issues. So help us with an introduction to the issue of methylation.
Methylation. Yeah, well, it is. If you haven't been studying it for a long time, just saying the word can be challenging. What is methylation? Well, it's a metabolic, so it's a process that occurs in the body. It's something that happens in every cell of the body all of the time. It's so exquisitely fundamental. And I think that because it's so fundamental and its influence is far reaching, that can make it a little bit challenging to wrap our heads around it because its impact and imbalance in it affects, you know, virtually everything. So methylation, a methyl group is a molecular compound. It's a carbon with three hydrogens, and we're always making methyl groups in the, quote, methylation cycle. And then in all these methyl transferase enzymatic reactions, we're taking that methyl group and we're putting it on to different metabolic compounds or we're taking it off of different metabolic compounds all over the body. And in doing so, we are making our DNA, we are altering how our DNA then expresses. We're making our immune cells, We're developing our nervous system. We're making and metabolizing hormones, neurotransmitters, and, you know, really an on. So very, very fundamental is methylation. Mm-hmm. We use it to detox and, you know, again, it's profound and far-reaching. So let me hush.
One of the ways that I understand it is that it is a little bit like a brake and an accelerator on your DNA. You know, your DNA has information that can produce all kinds of outcomes, but sometimes you want to put the brake on certain outcomes like cell proliferation. If you're worried about cancer, you actually want to stop that. And then, of course, you want to amp up the production of certain things like maybe brain neurotransmitters if you're depressed. So that's a role that methylation can play. It seems to, it's sort of a dualistic role, like it's a stop and a start.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. It makes compounds. It also helps us to metabolize compounds. Yes, and in the DNA, or in genetic material, it's beyond just DNA. If we methylate the DNA, that is, we put that little carbon and three hydrogens onto the DNA, we stop genetic expression. And if we remove that, or if the body removes it, that initiates genetic expression. And that can be very good, and it can be associated with, you know, really virtually all diseases. So an imbalance in this methylation of the, what we call the epigenome, this altered genetic expression, is associated with really virtually, you know, all diseases at this point. Much of the research has been in cancer, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but, tending to methylation, optimizing methylation, wellness imbalance is, I think, a revolutionary key, as you pointed out in our introduction, to good health.
So what are some of the factors that may subvert our methylation?
Well, you know what? We were talking about this, you and I, before we, when we just got on the phone, we were talking about some of the genetic mutations. And I want to mention them, and you can certainly ask me more questions about them, because it's something that people are understanding more and more. You can send in a saliva sample to 23andMe and get, you know, thousands of genetic mutations assessed or genes assessed, and then they'll send you back, you know, this massive list of whether or not it's a normal functioning gene or it's got a single nucleotide polymorphism in them. So more and more of us are understanding these, whether or not we have genetic SNPs, or these small genetic mutations. And we've put a lot of attention around the genes involved in methylation. MTHFR is one of our best known, best research genes, which is commonly, there's a small mutation in it, a SNP as we call it, in many, many of us. And that mutation can compromise how well we methylate. It can. I mean, there's many, many other variables in it, but I know that a lot of folks' entry into understanding methylation has to do with assessing their SNPs, and people become really concerned and anxious about them and think that they're, you know, therefore vulnerable to many, many diseases. And I would argue that, you know, that while they do, while these single nucleotide polymorphisms influence the course of disease or can, really there's a much broader, we want to, you know, expand our horizons, cast a much wider net in how we think about supporting methylation and what we think, you know, is going to be problematic or helpful.
Well, you know, from the standpoint of integrated practitioners, this is now on the radar screen, and a lot of doctors may be testing patients for that particular thing, MTHFR SNPs. And you can be, you know, fine, or you can have 1677. That's one mutation, C677. Another one is C1298. Or you can have a double hit, usually of 677, but sometimes rarely of 1298. Or you can be have a 677 and a 1298, and there's a tendency for integrative doctors to say, oh my goodness, you've got this mutation, you've got methylation problems, you need to take a lot of B vitamins. And is that
That's
a simplistic
right.
conclusion?
Right. I think so. So let's you know, let's just back up, Dr. Hoffman, and just and say that in this methylation cycle, the way that we make that carbon with three hydrogens, that methyl donor, is by you know, it relies on B12, it relies on folate, B6, magnesium. There's a host of nutrients.
Not just the B vitamins.
You know,
there's
a lot of nutrients. But as you rightly pointed out, the major players are folate and B12. Yes. So a clinician or a patient identifies that they've got some variation of MTHFR, so the C677 or the 1298, and they therefore start themselves or self-prescribe or their clinician prescribes quite a bit of these methyl donors, B12, folate, et cetera. Yes. Is this a simplistic approach? I would argue that it is, and that the research isn't that compelling that it's the correct way. And as we understand more and more about the epigenome, and methylation, you know, or hypermethylation, it may not be the safest way either. However,
because we're talking under methylation. Oh, you're not getting adequate methylation, but there are some concerns about over revving methylation. In fact, there's been some controversy about putting folic acid in our flour supply, you know, when we were trying to address an epidemic of neural tube defects. That was actually the public health measure that called that into being. So they wanted to fortify flour with folic acid. Yep. So then there was some controversy like, oh my goodness, could we be causing hypermethylation, which is self-associated with some problems, perhaps even the higher incidence of cancer? You know, that was the concern there.
Yeah, that's right.
But somewhat also dispelled that probably isn't the case, but theoretically, you know, we wonder.
Yeah, I know. That's right. It's a really, really good point, and it's a longer conversation than our time together today. But you're right. You're absolutely right. So we've fortified people in the countries in the West have by and large started fortifying their grains. And you know, the fact of the matter is we've absolutely reduced the incidence of neural tube defects.
Yes.
So it was, you know, really, I think a cost-benefit analysis, it was definitely in the benefit
column. The most effective thing since the March of Dimes. I mean, more than virtually anything that they've done to deal with these horrifying childhood disorders is this preventive fortification. And, you know, mothers now take prenatals that contain folic acid or, better yet, folate.
Yes.
And it's helping.
Yes, and so we absolutely have to recognize it and honor it, and that's right. Using natural folates in prenatal vitamins is a smart idea. So, but we also have this large sort of unwitting, you know, population who's been taking higher amounts of folic acid for a very long time. So what do we see? Are there any negatives when we look at the data? And the fact of the matter is it does suggest that there could be an increased risk for cancer. I do think the data bear this out. Not in individuals who are exposed to the highest amount, so have the highest blood levels of folate. So maybe they're eating just tons of grains, you know, sort of the carb addicts, and maybe they're also supplementing, etc. So there's some suggestion that too much folate could be an increased risk for certain cancers. And not all studies agree. So you are correct. There's some studies who, you know, that say there isn't a trend towards increased cancer. But I think when we look at the majority of them, there does appear to be a trend, maybe not a huge trend, but a slight increased risk of cancer in this increase, you know, taking more methyl donors and primarily folate. So I think that there's room for us to consider caution around it. It's what we call a U-curve distribution. So too little folate is a big problem. Insufficient folate is a big problem. Excess folate is also a big problem. And you could say this arguably about the other B vitamins, including B12. They're U-curves. We want to make sure we have a balance of them.
We sometimes call that the Goldilocks effect. Not too hot, not too cold, just right.
Yeah.
You know, so for
that's
sure.
That's exactly. Now, yeah, that's right.
Is some of this, and this has also been suggested, that the problem is not with the folate per se, but that you get an incomplete metabolism of folic acid, which actually is an artificial B vitamin. It's the folate that you get from foliage, like green leafy vegetables, that's the natural folate, and that may be better metabolized. The problem is unmetabolized folic acid is an issue?
Well, that's one of the issues. Well, you know, we are definitely going down the rabbit hole. So we don't activate the synthetic folic acid that's used in these fortifications as well. You know, these grain fortifications. We don't activate it as well. And that can cause an accumulation of intermediates that could have their own problems. So that's potential issue, you know, number one. However, that's not the only concern. And if we say, okay, let's wholesale move away from using the synthetic folic acid, let's stop folic acid and only use natural folates, we're going to be fine. And I would say no.
Not
I don't think that the data suggests that.
Yeah.
And again, it isn't that there's a problem with B vitamins in and of themselves. It's when we go crazy with higher amounts and higher amounts for longer periods of time. We can look at this epigenome, or the alteration of our genetic expression, and see that we can hypermethylate on the genome, and we can actually shut down some very important genes.
Mm-hmm.
For one, tumor suppressor genes, so some of the genes that inhibit cancer, shut down cancer, clear it up.
That's a double negative, which yields a positive. If we shut down something that inhibits cancer, then it becomes a cancer promoter, in effect.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Good.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sometimes we get lost in these trains of thought, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. And so we want to be mindful around the possibility that high dose, long term pushing of methylation, with extra B vitamins, because we think that we're doing right based on these mutations that we have, might actually be in the long run harmful, and that high dose long term supplementation is not necessarily the best way. Now, under the guidance of a physician, and when you're testing and you actually identify a need for the methyl donors, your homocysteine is high. That's one of the classic methyl donor biomarkers.
Exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to say, you know, what about the patient where we see a homocysteine that's like 12 or 15, and that's a patient where we're concerned about the adverse effects of the homocysteine, so we drive it down sometimes very effectively with B12 folate, and some of the formulas have B6, and sometimes use TMG or trimethylglycine, and that is a very effective strategy, but then that is okay, we think, under those circumstances?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, because it's the goal. So for the genetic expression, Goldilocks is there as well.
Yep.
So you want balanced, sufficient methylation on our genetic material. You absolutely do. So we hypomethylation, or insufficient methyl donors on the genome where they're supposed to be, has a whole collection of negative consequences as well. So this hypermethylation of the genome isn't good, and this hypomethylation of the genome can equally be problematic. So we want balanced. And yes, if you see an elevated homocysteine, by all means address it. If you see a low B12 or any other indicator that the body needs this, absolutely address it.
Push it higher.
But normalize it. Yeah, provide B12 if somebody needs B12. Mm. I do it all of the time. I use these B vitamins in my practice. But the change for me in understanding sort of these subtle perturbations of genetic expression has been, I don't want to use them as long, and I may not go as quite as high in the dosing, for a shorter duration. But I'm going way upstream, and I'm thinking of how else can we support healthy methylation.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, you know, as you know, we wrote an ebook and actually started a program in our practice called Methylation Diet and Lifestyle, where we're just casting a much wider net. So we're not leaning on the B vitamins as much. We're looking at all of these other variables that impact methylation that I'd love to talk to you about.
Great. Let's reserve that conversation for part two. I have a couple more questions in part one. There's been really a great deal of enthusiasm for high-dose folate. Pharmaceutical companies are making high-dose folate.
Yes.
There's a medication called Deplin, which is actually used for patients getting psychiatric meds to sort of act as hamburger helper for their psych meds. And there's even another one that is being used for patients who have memory problems and dementia, which is, again, folate, high-dose folate, for basically to support the brain. So those might be other instances where we're going to use high-dose folate therapeutically and worry less about the consequences?
Yeah. Well, I think, I would say that yes. I would say that there are instances where we want to go with high dose. Absolutely. Especially when you get a beneficial clinical outcome and it's obvious. Mm-hmm. Memory restoration, you know, a lifting of depression. There's a demand for more of the methyl donors in the body in that individual. However, you know, as we're going to talk about in part two, I would still argue for this casting a wider net of really smart interventions to optimize methylation balance. But I want to just continue through this line of questioning before we get into those those ideas. So what else do you have?
Hit me with your best shots. Okay, so while we're talking about nutrients, let's talk about just, you know, before we get to part two, there's a constellation of nutrients that seem to impact methylation, and we rattled them off. But so we're talking about B6, maybe preferably in a P5P form, B12, maybe in a methylated form. It's sort of premium, luxury B12, more expensive, but maybe more bioavailable. And then not folic acid, but folate. Those are the three top ones. But then what are some of the ancillary ones that support methylation? You mentioned a real outlier, which is magnesium.
Yeah, magnesium. So any reaction in the body that requires energy, as ATP, is going to need some magnesium. And since the process of us making our methyl donors requires energy, magnesium is involved in it. Potassium is involved in some of the steps. We know DHA from fish oil can actually promote turning on the methylation cycle. Glycine, one of our amino acids, the smallest amino acid in the body, is involved in helping to methylate folate. What else? We've got
riboflavin, is riboflavin part of that pathway in some way?
Yep.
B2?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, and of course, methionine, our essential amino acid that has the sulfur group on it, is, you know, central. Methionine, as the name implies, is central to the methylation cycle.
And SAMe fits into that picture somehow
Yes. So what I've been referring to as our, you know, as the methyl donor, as this carbon with the three hydrogens, it's actually part of a compound called S-adenosyl methionine, SAMe, as you mentioned. So that's where that methyl group is, and we produce in the methylation cycle SAMe that has that methyl group, and then that methyl group goes around the body and makes hormones or helps metabolize hormones or, you know, detoxes or builds neurotransmitters, et cetera, et cetera.
So this may be a key to the multitude of effects some of these nutrients have on the body. We call coenzyme Q10 ubiquinone. This is also something that's ubiquitous in its effects. It affects virtually every cell, every process in the body.
Yep.
Okay.
That's right. It sure does.
Okay. So this is a good point which to pause. But, you know, before we get into methylation lifestyle, which is a fascinating subject because we tend to think of it as, oh, just pop this pill, fix your methylation. It's more, there's more to it than that. I'll also want to ask you in part two, what are some of the conditions that might suggest to a patient or a clinician that methylation should be investigated? We'll stay tuned for that answer in just a moment. Our guest is Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. She is with a practice called Integrative and Functional Medicine in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, but she's also a teacher of physicians on subjects related to functional medicine. And just before we end this segment, give us some information on how to obtain that lifestyle guidebook on methylation.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So your audience has a discount. If they use Intelligent 10, they'll get 10% off. And they can go to my website, which is Dr. Kara, K-A-R-A, Fitzgerald.com, drkarafitzgerald.com, and they will get a pop-up screen immediately where they can download some information and an introduction to the book to see whether or not you want to purchase it. And if you're interested, it'll take you right over to the page and you can read all about the book. We've got quite a bit on the site about methylation diet and lifestyle program. In addition to the book, we've got the methylation supportive recipes, and we've got loads of blogs, and awesome. You know, we've got some other podcasts. Yeah, there's just all sorts of great material. So head over to the website, remember Intelligent 10, and you can grab the book for a discount.
drkarafitzgerald.com.
Okay.
That's right. Great. All right. We'll pause now. When we return, more on the subject of methylation with today's guest, Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.